Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I believe we're going to hear the first case via speakerphone on behalf of the lawyer for the appellant. Do we have that set up now? Ms. Deason, are you here?
Ms. Deason, you're
right. Deason, sorry about that. All right, good. So you're here and you may proceed. Would you like me to tell you when you're running into your rebuttal time?
Yes, please, Your Honor.
All right.
May it please the court, Mr. Bass. The sole issue before the court today is whether or not the district court abuses its discretion in not allowing Ross Thacker to present the details of his plea agreement in state court, a plea agreement that concerned a series of robberies that were identical to the robberies he was being prosecuted for in federal court. But perhaps in a broader or more important sense, this case is really about the disparity in the treatment between agreements and offers of immunity concerning cooperating government witnesses and defendants. In this case, Ross Thacker and Samaji Warren were both suspected of committing a number of armed robberies in Champaign County. Ross Thacker was ultimately charged with three of the robberies in state court. He was offered a plea agreement by the prosecution, and he accepted. Under the terms of the agreement, if Thacker made a complete and truthful statement concerning his involvement and the involvement of others in these series of armed robberies, he would be allowed to plead to one armed robbery count and receive a sentence of 6 years.
But, you know, I understand why you think this might be a little bit favorable to him, but first of all, we're dealing with a situation in which the district court has discretion about admission of evidence. Secondly, it doesn't strike me that it's necessarily as favorable as you portray it. It seems quite possibly not such a strong inference. And thirdly, we have the harmless error rule here. It strikes me that there was quite a bit of evidence anyway against Mr. Thacker. So I'm not sure how you overcome one or all of those problems.
Well, with respect to whether or not it would be favorable, I think that that's a decision that the defendant has to make. This court has said that the jury should be allowed to hear this evidence to make the decision on their own.
But it's not only the defendant's decision. The judge, in evaluating whether the evidence should come in, also has a role to play.
But the judge, in deciding that the evidence would not come in, the judge decided that it would be too prejudicial, I assume, to the government. The judge thought that it would be confusing to the jury and that the jury may somehow feel that Mr. Thacker was unfairly treated because he was prosecuted in both courts. And I think a limiting instruction would have taken care of that. The third issue you raised, harmless error. There are no eyewitnesses that put Mr. Thacker at the scene of any of these robberies with the exception of the one he pled to. And he himself put himself at the scene at the one he admitted to. A large part of the government's case here depended upon the testimony of cooperating co-defendants and unindicted co-conspirators who all had a motive to testify against Mr. Thacker.
Yes, but there were several of them. There were three of them who testified against him. Normally, that's regarded as competent evidence, even though, of course, they can be impeached. But it does strike me that there's a lot of evidence here.
Well, even though they all testified against him cumulatively, perhaps that could be seen as weighty. If you look at each of the individual's testimony, there's evidence that they testified falsely. You know, if you look at the history of Mr. Warren, you know, he's arrested. He denies being involved at all. He ultimately says he's involved. He still decides to go to court. He takes the position that the gun wasn't real, which is ridiculous, you know. And then, you know, he gives false information about other federal prisoners in an attempt to win favor with the U.S. Attorney's Office. And most importantly, at trial, he tried to put a gun in Mr. Thacker's hand when the physical evidence indicated that that was not true. So I don't think, even in a cumulative sense, that the testimony of these three individuals was in any way insurmountable. And I think that the jury had a right to hear the circumstances under which Mr. Thacker made his statement. he's told by the state authorities that if he is truthful, he can get a sentence of 6 years. He has no reason to be untruthful at that point. He has no idea that there is going to be a federal prosecution. And, you know, to address the prejudicial effect, I think it's ridiculous to state that the jury would be confused. If they can understand that Mr. Thacker was prosecuted in state court for similar crimes, and they can certainly understand that he received an agreement in state court regarding those crimes.
Well, I mean, but in fairness to the district judge's balancing, which is essentially a Rule 403 process, there are plenty of people who don't understand the intricacies between when the states can prosecute and when the federal government can prosecute and how these things relate to one another. The judge, again, bearing in mind that it's a discretionary call for the district court judge, might feel that he doesn't want to waste an awful lot of trial time on that kind of side issue.
I don't believe that it would require a great deal of time. That's what we have limited instructions for.
The problem here seems to be that it wasn't so much that he was prohibited from talking about this guilty plea in state court, but that he wanted to call a state's attorney and an Illinois detective to testify about the intricacies of his negotiations with the state that culminated in his guilty plea. And that, I can understand why a district court judge wouldn't want to get into hearing matters like that. Where was he precluded from talking about this? It wasn't the whole thing that he wanted to call these other witnesses?
It was my understanding, and it still is, that the district court judge precluded the issue being raised at all.
But the issue being raised by calling those other witnesses.
That was not my understanding, you know, and I think that the record does bear that out. I don't know that it would be less confusing for the jury to hear it from the state's attorney's office or Mr. Thacker's attorney as opposed to hearing it from Mr. Thacker himself. The import of the judge's ruling was that it would be confusing, and the government argued that it could lead to jury nullification because the jury would not understand. So I don't believe that I was limited in not calling those particular witnesses. I think that the judge's ruling precluded me from raising that issue at all. And again, I do believe that it is an issue that the jury would have understood. I do believe that it was crucial in this case. We have a specific jury instruction that tells the jury that they are to consider the circumstances under which a witness makes a particular statement. And I think the circumstances under which Mr. Thacker made his statement to state authorities is essential to the jury in determining his credibility. I don't believe that that is any more prejudicial or bolsters his credibility any more than the government is allowed to do with their cooperating witnesses.
Justin, you know, Ms. Dyson, your rebuttal time is now running.
Okay, then I will leave it at that, Your Honor.
All right, thank you very much. We'll hear now from Mr. Bass for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court, Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, with respect to Ms. Dyson, this case is not about broader implications of the admissibility of plea agreements or plea negotiations, whether they be government witnesses or whether they be the defendants themselves. As Your Honor, Judge Wood raised, this case is simply about whether or not the district court properly exercised its discretion. It's not an issue of whether there's only one reasonable side to come down on with respect to this argument. Ms. Dyson makes an argument that's not frivolous as to why she believed that this evidence had some relevance to the defendant's credibility. But even assuming that to be true, the government's argument and the district court's finding and the manner in which it exercised its discretion was to say that this evidence had some potential, if not a strong potential, and it was our position it was a strong potential, to inevitably lead to jury confusion and a risk of prejudice by the jury concluding that there was somehow some unfairness by the federal government prosecuting the defendant after the defendant introduces evidence by promises from state officials who had nothing to do with the federal prosecution.
Maybe you were worried that the jury would wonder why the federal government was prosecuting, you know, $170 thefts of convenience stores. I don't usually, a lot of people don't think of that as a federal case, right?
Well, one in and of itself, no, Your Honor, but this case, I think the record bears out, there were three robberies actually charged, but there were a total of eight or more robberies within the Champaign-Urbana area, all with guns by persons such as, primarily by Mr. Thacker and Mr. Warnon. It was our position at that time that repeated use of guns and violence was something that warranted federal prosecution, particularly when you consider that Mr. Thacker ended up getting only 6 years of imprisonment for the one that he pleaded guilty to. But again, Your Honors, the issue is under an evidentiary ruling on appellate review of a district court's exercise of its discretion. The question is not whether there's the defendant's argument is a reasonable one. The question is only whether or not the district court abused its discretion, meaning that no reasonable jurist could have come to the district judge's conclusion. That clearly is not the case here. The record in the citations to the district court's reasoning in our brief clearly show that the district court considered the defendant's argument and then exercised his discretion in making a finding that this evidence was outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice.
Is your understanding of the scope of the ruling the same as Ms. Dyson's, namely that not even Mr. Thacker could talk about these things?
I wouldn't disagree with that, Your Honor. It was clear that the manner in which, at least to me, that it was clear the manner in which the defendant wished to present this evidence was through the testimony of the state's attorney and the detective.
Yeah, but was the question, did he ask to testify on his own behalf on that subject and was precluded from doing so?
I think that is an accurate assessment of the district court's ruling. It was clear that the district judge
didn't want the subject touched at all by anybody.
Right, Your Honor. But Mr. Thacker was permitted to testify that he had pleaded guilty. There clearly was evidence before the jury that he had pleaded guilty.
But of course, the evidence he wants somehow or another is that he denied guilt on one of them, and he sees this as a circumstance where he had no motive to lie about that, and thus somehow it bolsters his credibility on the denial.
Correct, Your Honor. The district judge's ruling clearly prohibited him or anyone else from bringing before the jury the issue that the state's officials had promised him immunity and promised not to prosecute him. That was the evidence that was excluded in any form. And again, whether or not the defendant's argument is reasonable, whether or not there may be some circumstances in which state court plea negotiations might be admissible. The defendant cites this consciousness of innocence argument in his reply brief. Again, even assuming those are reasonable arguments, the only question here is whether the district court properly exercised its discretion with some reasoning. He clearly did. He weighed the countervailing balances and made a ruling. That's what district courts do. It was not an abuse of discretion. For that reason, Your Honor, we would ask that the conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bass. Ms. Dyson, you have 2 minutes.
I would just like to add that I think that the district court's decision was an abuse of discretion in light of the fact that the jury did hear evidence that Mr. Thacker had, in fact, been prosecuted in state court for similar and connected crimes. And I think his conclusion that it would lead to jury nullification or confusion on the part of the jury is unreasonable in light of the fact that they were aware that there was a state prosecution crime. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will take this case under advisement. I should have said this is United States versus Thacker, number 051645. And we